And while you're kind of taking a look at the second page of your handout, which I think is the quiz, I would simply tell you that most of what I have to say today does not have anything to do with my role as the president of the American Civil Liberties Union. I teach classes for seniors, both in Tampa and here at the Perrin Springs Academy. I'm actually teaching one here now in called Geopolitics. And this is part of things that I put into a geopolitics class once in a while. I'm teaching one starting in January on terrorism. 6 weeks for all you ever wanted to know about terrorism. So if you're interested, there is information back on the table about that class. And if you're interested in attending, we would certainly love to have you participate. Now to the quiz. Okay, question number one. In the past 60 years, how many times have countries engaged in violence over water disputes? 37, 88, 145. How many think A? How many think B? How many don't really care? Okay, the answer is 37 in the last 60 years. The good news is that's not very many, and we have more treaties on water than we have wars about water so far. The bad news is that the situation is going to get worse. What percentage of the world's population depends on water sourced from the Tibetan Plateau? You've got a picture of that plateau a little bit on your thing. It's actually 47%, because if you take a look at what happens from the Tibetan Plateau, it basically feeds all the rivers that feed China and Pakistan. How much water does it take to grow a kilogram of wheat? That's 2.2 pounds. 1,000 liters. Okay. In developing countries, how far per day does the average girl or woman walk in order to fetch water? You've got some pictures on the back about women doing that. In many countries in the third world, women's lives are defined by going to get water. And the answer is 3.7 miles. What percent, he has a gift for hyperbole anyway. What percentage of illnesses in the developing world can be attributed to unsafe water? Really have to buy their water, and it's very expensive. Now, I noticed some of you were carrying the traditional bottle of water with you this morning. How much water does it take to produce a 1 liter of bottled water? 3 liters. Okay. One to fill the bottle, and two for the industrial processes and so forth that go along. Now, if you really want to take a look at the interesting part of this thing, take a look at the bottom of that page, because you think of water when you water your lawn, fill your swimming pool, drink, cook, bathroom facilities, etc., etc. That's the way you think of water. But literally, every industrial process and every agricultural process requires water. And someone developed, and this is, by the way, I think from the National Geographic magazine, that talks about how much water it takes to basically make the kinds of things that are listed there. So when you take a look and you see that water is out there, water is not only for you to use, but it's also for to make almost anything you might need uses large amounts of water. Now, water is life. Okay? 70% of the Earth's surface is covered by water. It differs from other resources because for many of its primary uses, there is absolutely no substitute. You must have it. It's so critical that the United Nations voted in 2010 to say that access to clean water was a human right. But that's easier to say than it is to do. T. Boone Pickens, who basically was in the oil business, as many of you will remember, is now in the water business, and he says that water is the new oil, and he calls it blue gold. Our deepest concerns about water are pretty interesting. We're concerned about having too little of it, and we're concerned about having too much of it. What's our current example? Hurricane Sandy. Water is affected by all kinds of things. It's affected by climate change. Hurricane Andrew was a disaster for this state, but it was much less a disaster than Hurricane Sandy, which was a hurricane, Category 1 hurricane, and Andrew was a Category 4 or 5 hurricane, depending on where you read. What's the difference? Why all of a sudden was the New York storm, lower category hurricane, more devastating? Not only storm surge, you've got it, the breadth. Hurricane Andrew was about 200 plus miles wide. Hurricane Sandy was 800 plus miles wide. So you begin to take a look at it, and water is a really real problem. At the same time we're having too much water with Hurricane Sandy, what are we experiencing in the Midwest where we grow our food? Drought. So having too much water or too little water is the kind of problems that we're going to face all the way down the line. Water exists on the earth because our atmosphere holds it in. Okay, it prevents it from floating away or being disintegrated by solar radiation. Our problem is that we need to look at our traditional sources of water like a bank, and that right now our withdrawals are exceeding our deposits, a trend that's likely to continue over an extremely long period of time. We are headed for a freshwater crisis. Now, water is renewable, but it's not unlimited. It will become extremely scarce as population grows. Right now we have about 6.9 to 7 million billion people in the world. We'll get to about 9.5 billion in about 25 years or so. And when that happens, you'll have that many more claimants for the fresh water that people need. Now, our aquifers, our rivers, our lakes, our snow and ice cover are all being depleted at higher rates than they can be replenished. How many of you have taken a cruise to Alaska and gone on up to Denali recently? You'll find out that up there, you'll see constant runoff of water during the summer months, all that sort of thing, and it's more than's actually being replaced, and glaciers all over the world are retreating. And that's an important development. Global consumption of water is slated to double about every 20 years. And the renewable supply of water has declined about 58% since 1950, as the population increased from about 2.6 billion to almost 7 billion right now. In 15 years, there will be 1.8 billion people on the face of the earth who live in regions of extreme water scarcity. That's a lot. Now, global warming is a major problem. When I teach this in my global issues or global geopolitics class, I teach four basic issues. One is on demographics, what's happening with regard to the number of people on the planet, where they're going to be, and what the problems are associated with that. Then we talk about oil, which is obviously a major problem because we have more people worrying about the need for oil. Then I talk about water. Then I talk about global warming. But demographics is a major problem, and that's going to exacerbate the difficulties that we have with water. It's going to make some regions more drought-prone than they already are. It's going to eliminate sources of water that people depend on. It's kind of an interesting thing. The amount of moisture on the earth has not changed. In National Geographic, they once said that the water that the dinosaurs drank millions of years ago is the same water we have around today. Where do we get our water? We get it from surface water, groundwater under the ground in the aquifer. We get it from melting snow and glaciers. We get it from desalination. Now, the aquifer is really important. How many of you are familiar with the big issue about the pipeline coming down from Canada and so forth? The difficulty is that people want to build the Keystone Pipeline right over the Ogallala Aquifer, which basically supplies water for farming and people, human consumption all over the Midwestern states west of the Mississippi. And to do that casually, frankly, is stupid. Even though we do need the oil, it's kind of foolish to turn around and get oil unless we make sure that we're not going to contaminate the aquifer first. How many of you are familiar with fracking? Fracking is a big danger, and everybody worries that we might do damage to the aquifer in the process. Now, if water covers 70% of the Earth's surface, why are we worried about it? Okay, well, the answer is very simple. Water comes in different types. 97.5% of all the water in the world is salty and not fit for human consumption unless it's processed. 2.5% of our water is fresh. And over two-thirds of the fresh water is ice. Now, we all know from general science back in high school that there's a water cycle. Water evaporates, it condenses, comes back to Earth as a precipitation. But fresh water is a big problem. We have about 9.25 trillion gallons of fresh water out there, but 69.7% of it, almost 70%, is in ice sheets, glaciers, permanent snow cover, or down in the permafrost. 30% of it is in soil and aquifers that are fed by surface seepage that comes down through. And about 0.4% of our fresh water is in lakes, rivers, wetlands, water in plants, animals, and in the atmosphere. So when you really begin to take a look at it, this is from a recent CIA report. Earlier this year, the Director of National Intelligence put together a report on water, and I was happy to find that it really tracked my presentations absolutely, including the areas where we were likely to have trouble. But this kind of shows how the amount of water comes down to trickle down to the point where we need to worry about the water and the fresh water that we use because it's very critical to everything that we're likely to do. Now, if you're going to go ahead and turn around and have water savings, this is a pretty interesting issue. Where do you get your biggest water savings? People encourage you to take shorter showers, right? To not water your lawn, to make different kinds of arrangements with regard to what you plant in your lawn, make it less more friendly to the natural atmosphere. But the fact of the matter is that 70% of the fresh water in the world is used for what?
Agriculture.
Exactly. So if we're going to turn around and we're going to make savings in water, and fresh water, you're going to make most of your savings in the area where you have what? The greatest potential for savings. Any major change, reducing the amount of water we use for agriculture by 2 or 3 or 4% over time, would have a tremendous impact on water for every other process. Industrial uses are a big problem. 22% of the fresh water we have is used in industrial purposes of some kind or another. So if we're going to make progress on the water issue, we have to do it in agriculture, we have to do it in industrial use, and having the kinds of programs that we have in town to get you to brush your teeth and use less water, make your shower shorter, water your lawn less, get rid of your swimming pool, et cetera, et cetera. All of that's nice to do, but the real savings are in industry and so forth. Levi Strauss has actually come out with a new pair of Levi's that are basically stonewashed, which used to be a water process, and now is done without water. We need to have those kinds of things in the way we go out. 8% is for human consumption. Now, there's some water facts you ought to think about. The biggest problem with water is unequal consumption and unequal distribution. Lots of places have lots of water. Lots of places don't have nearly enough. Lots of places consume lots of water. Lots of places can't consume lots of water. The highest population growth areas and the place where we're going to have our demographic explosion over the next 30 years are going to be in areas where water is scarce. The average American uses about 158 gallons of water per day, direct or indirect. Okay? About 100 gallons of that is used in our homes. We use it for water and recreation. We play golf. We do all sorts of things. We like boating. We like fishing, and so forth. By contrast, people in the poorest areas of the world live on 5 gallons of water a day or less. Now, that has a lot of implications. People in the poorest areas in developing countries, that's women's work. And you've got some pictures there. A picture is sometimes worth 1,000 words. And in your packet, you'll see some pictures of women engaged in what women in the third world frequently do. And that is their job and the job of their children, female children usually, is to provide the family with water. And they've got to go and get it and they've got to carry it home. You have a real problem of excessive uses. You have a real problem of unequal consumption. The distribution from the source to point of usage is always a major problem. In developed countries, we have well-developed water systems. Now, there's a problem with those water systems because that's an investment in infrastructure, and because our current war against all things government basically starves the government of the ability to turn around and save water by constructing new infrastructure or improving the infrastructure we've got. How many of you lived in New York? Where'd your water come from?
Westchester.
It comes through an 85-mile tunnel, okay, from upstate. Now, that tunnel loses something like 30 million gallons of fresh water a day. Mm-hmm. Fixing the tunnel would save lots of water, okay? But fixing the tunnel would require a huge investment in resources that in today's political climate is a major problem. The privatization of water is a problem. There are a lot of countries that have tried, and some states that have tried, some cities that have tried, to put the water distribution and so forth in private hands. There's a difficulty with that economically. Okay, because what happens almost immediately is they try to go ahead and find economies, they cut staff, they do all sorts of things, the price of water goes up, and you can't basically make up the price of the increase in cost by the conservation measures that you might try to use as a result. In many cases, you have an economic concept called elasticity, where people can adjust their demand based on their resources and things like that. But you can't do that with water. There's some minimum requirement for water that everybody has to have that you can't adjust. And most places that have tried the privatization of water have had problems with it, and many of them have gone back to government controls. Beijing in China is having a similar problem. They privatized drilling in the local aquifer. They're drilling now to about 2/3 of a mile deep. The costs there have skyrocketed. The poor can no longer afford the services. A major problem, to cede an essential commodity like water for short-term economic benefit to private companies who are in it for profit is, I think, immoral, and it's dangerous, and it's wrong. Now, there are some other privatization issues. You might not know it, but people are going all around the Midwest. I'll use Nestle as a company I know about. Nestle is going around, and it's basically purchasing water rights. Why? They want a source of water for their bottled water. Now, the problem is that if you have water rights for an area, you can go down there and you can drain off all the water you want if it's not regulated. The problem is that water comes in from all kinds of places, and you're basically short-stopping everybody else. T. Boone Pickens interestingly enough, mentioned him earlier, is purchasing all kinds of water rights in the Texas Panhandle. He had the state of Texas declare him a water district, which gives him some governmental powers. He used those governmental powers to literally create a 200-mile corridor from the Texas Panhandle down to Dallas and Fort Worth. And basically, he wants to get water and power. He's got wind things there, and he wants to use that corridor to transmit the water and the power from wind energy all the way down to major metropolitan areas. He thinks he can make a lot of money that way. In Sitka, Alaska, how many of you have seen the Blue Lake up there in Sitka? Huge, beautiful, gorgeous lake. The city council up there authorized a thing called the True Alaska Bottling Company to basically pump up to 3 billion gallons a year of water from Blue Lake. It's then put on tankers, sent to Mumbai where it's bottled, and then it's moved out to the Middle East, where the water is actually sold in bottled water. There's a problem with theft of water. There's major issues in many companies because, for example, in Mumbai recently, the local mafia managed to steal water destined for the city slums and sold it in richer neighborhoods. And they had water riots there. Bottled water is something. We're all crazy about bottled water. The problem is that it's anywhere from 240 to 1,000 times more expensive than the stuff you get from your tap. Now that makes, and not only that, but it takes a lot of water just to produce the bottles and things like that that it uses, and it takes a huge amount of petrochemicals in order to move it from place to place, gasoline, diesel, et cetera, et cetera. And the landfill, that's the next thing. The landfill, this stuff doesn't go away for thousands of years. And it's out there. 41 billion gallons of bottled water were sold in 2004. That was up 57% in a five-year period. And I haven't been able to find what I think is a reliable figure of how it's sold today, but it's obviously increasing. It's economically wasteful. The transportation consumes lots of fossil fuels. It's environmentally damaging. Yet we go ahead and we don't regulate bottled water because we would be regulating an industry that people like. Now let's talk a little bit about the geopolitics of water. The last time two nations actually went to war, I mean, really serious war over water, was about 4,500 years ago between two cities in Mesopotamia. The water problems continue there, and that's an area today of great potential conflict. There have been about 3,600 international treaties related to water because most water basically crosses international borders in ways that are inconvenient, rivers, aquifers, et cetera, et cetera. When you dam up a river, what do? You prevent and you control the amount of water that people down the river are having. So guess some places where you might see that. Well, go back to Mesopotamia, where you have the Tigris and Euphrates. Where do they originate? Anybody? Turkey, absolutely. And if the Turks, as they are going to do and have done already, start building dams in order to control water there, they basically control the amount of water that goes through Syria and even to Iraq. And with Iraq, that's about 100% of their water supply that, from groundwater and flow from the rivers. So that's a major issue. In many countries, there's a potential for internal threat. Because you're going to have competition within the country for the scarce water resources between people who live in slums and the people who live in nice neighborhoods. In China, on the way down here this morning, I was listening to public radio, and they had this wonderful story about the Three Gorges Dam. Now, that's kind of an interesting thing, because when we talk about the Tibetan Plateau in a minute, we're going to find out that the water that goes down to the Three Gorges Dam comes from where? The Tibetan Plateau, okay? And when it comes down there, it's melting at a rapid rate, and at some point in time, the flow of the Yellow and Yangtze rivers is way down below what it historically has been. You have these huge dams. China is building them all the time. They actually have built a canal that they've tried to move water from one river to the other in order to make sure that people downriver have water. China is going to have huge water problems along the line as the resource of the Tibetan Plateau is basically compromised and reduced over the next 20 or 30 years. So internally, countries are going to have problems, both with the amount of total water, and then what happens to the everybody else down the river from China, because all the rivers in South Asia basically are fed by the Tibetan Plateau. The Vietnamese are all, and the Laotians are already quite upset because China is controlling the amount of water on the Mekong River, which goes down into those countries and is a major source of fresh water for them. So all of that's out there. The Tibetan Plateau, and you've got, I think, a nice picture of that on one of these things, if I can find mine. The Tibetan Plateau is really an interesting place. It's been described as the remotest place on the planet Earth. It's the highest, largest plateau on Earth. The average altitude is over 12,000 feet. It's the largest ice mass in the world outside of the polar ice caps, and it's been called Asia's freshwater bank account. The Yellow River, the Yangtze, the Mekong, the Ganges, the Indus, and many other rivers in South Asia all are fed by that plateau and the ice and the precipitation that occurs there. It's warming twice as fast as the global rate. The area's 37,000 different glaciers are receding at unprecedented rates. The total has shrunk about 6% since 1970. But in northern India, the shrinkage has been about 20%. Now, when that bank account of water stored in ice and snow begins to be reduced significantly, you could just begin to look down the river systems and you'll begin to find out that we're going to inherit huge problems, because that takes care of about 45% or so of the world's population. Now, annual runoffs are projected to decrease by 14% for the Brahmaputra and 24% for the Indus River, which goes where? Pakistan. And inconveniently, it also goes through what country on the way?
India.
They're, I guess, natural enemy. One-sixth of the plateau is now desert or grasslands. It's dying out. Water holes are drying up. The nomadic peoples who live there are being forced to migrate away from the area. And if you move south, the glacial melt has caused flooding. You got abundant water at some times and eventual depletion over the long haul. China has real problems. They have less water than Canada, and they have 40 times more people. So the distribution of water is a major issue. Extraordinary. Urban use of water is going to become extremely important. In my demographics class, one of the things we really talk about, a part of the segment of that, is on urban growth in the third world. Delhi now has about 17 million people. It may actually grow to reach 63 million people as a result of natural increase and people migrating to the cities in 25 years. Now imagine what that would be, because the Yamuna River, which is a tributary of the Ganges, goes through that area. All the water originates on the Himalaya, the Tibetan Plateau. And you're going to have these people. They're not going to have water systems. They're not going to have distribution systems. And the one thing you can say is the difference between China and India is that China is at least trying to plan for their problems, but the Indians basically are way behind the power curve. Their population is growing. They're creating these huge urban structures, but they're not creating. It's supposedly a holy river. Hindu worshippers like to go there and wash themselves. There's some pictures out there of these people in that water. I wouldn't go in that water for all the money in the world or the tea in China. But the slums are a basic problem. The city gets two-thirds of its water from rivers that depend on the Tibetan plateau. So India and Bangladesh have problems because India controls the water going into Bangladesh. India controls the water going into Pakistan. They've had a treaty that dates back to the 1950s between Pakistan and India that has worked pretty well and has continued to work through several wars. But they actually need to conduct put some dams on the Indus River going into Pakistan to help control flooding and all kinds of other things that go on down there. The difficulty that you run into is that the natural place to build them happens to be in Indian-controlled Kashmir. Okay. And that's not going to work out very well, we think. The Jordan River. You know, symbol of peace. You've all read about that in the Bible. The Jordan River is a major problem. It's caused problems between the Jordanians, the Israelis, and the Syrians, and the Lebanese. All of them have a stake in that river. It flows south through the Sea of Galilee and south onto the Dead Sea, but it's a source of major contention. I don't know whether I sent you this map. Is this map in your thing? Take a look here, and you'll find that in this river structure that the Israelis have built what they call the Israeli National Water Carrier that takes water from the sea, and it takes it all the way down to Tel Aviv and southern Israel. Now, who does that not serve? The Palestinians. Not only that, but there's great competition between the Palestinians and the Israelis to pump the aquifer that happens to be in that region. The Israelis are using very deep wells down to about 1,000 feet. The Palestinians are pretty much limited to about 200-foot wells. And water is a major source of major scarcity for the Palestinian population, which is growing much faster demographically than the Israeli population. So you're going to find that water is just another source of problems between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Actually, since about 1950, there have been about 37 small conflicts between Israel and its neighbors over the issue of water. Some of them have actually come to shooting, minor things. Really kind of interesting. In 1960, Israel actually attacked Syria after it attempted to block one of the sources of the Jordan River. Terrorists, Palestinians, have attacked the pipelines of the National Water Carrier for Israel. The Tigris and Euphrates Basin, we've already talked about. Turkish dams are going to be a major problem. So what do you do about it? There is a thing out there called the Joint Operations Estimate, and you can actually Google that and you can find it. It was prepared about 4 or 5 years ago, and it addresses the major problems that we're likely to see over the next period of time that might impact military operations. And four of the major factors that will impact military operations and U.S. security and things like that going forward are demographics, oil, water, and global warming. Conflicts that we're likely to get involved in whether we want to or not. Now, what do you do? Well, I suggest that if you knew what to do about this, you should be able to run for president and win. Except the difficulty would be that most of the people, A, are unaware that they have a serious problem, or B, just don't care yet. It's not happening to them. They can walk in and turn on their tap. But there are some things that we can do to improve our water losses. We could improve our infrastructure. We could build selected dams, which would control and store water. Although when you do that in China, they've displaced millions and millions of people as a result of the dams, and they haven't done a very good job of resettling them. We could agree to consumption limits. But the places where we really need to worry about is we need to have a national program in this country and a worldwide program that would begin to focus on reducing the water requirements for agriculture, because we're going to have to produce more food, but we have to produce it with less water. We need to worry about new ways of manufacturing products that use less water. And at the same time, we can do our part. And the real value of these campaigns that we do locally is that they make people aware with the fact that water is important, that it is scarce, and that we need to safeguard it. The amount of water that actually gets saved is kind of negligible. But every little bit helps. Now, the other problem we're going to have to do is we're going to have to worry about whether we're going to contend for water or whether we're going to cooperate for water. And cooperation is much the better way, but it may not be a way that satisfies everybody. Egypt has already told the countries down the Nile River that if they make any attempt whatsoever to go ahead and control the flow of the Nile River through Egypt, that Egypt is prepared to go to war. And you'll find that many countries will have that same situation. So water is a real major problem. And there are things we could do. We could capture rainwater. We could worry about improving supply. We need to worry about how to fix our groundwater problem, which is gradually being reduced. We need to increase our storage capacities. Desalination is a big issue. It has two major problems. What are they? Cost is one, and salt. Yeah, when all of a sudden you start desalination of water, you create a lot of brine, and the brine basically goes back into your water source, and it becomes a polluting thing that basically kills all kinds of things. There are ways to do it, but Japan right now relies heavily on desalination. Saudi Arabia is using a lot of desalination in order to improve its water supply. Right now, you have a situation in Yemen. I read an article last night in Foreign Policy magazine that talked about the difficulty you're having there. It's an extraordinary problem. And I will tell you that I don't have all the solutions. But I can make you conscious of the fact that we really need to have a major effort in this country and in the world, probably with U.S. leadership, to try to address the problems of water and to invest in solutions in water, because you're not going to be able to do that through the private sector. Unfortunately, probably Governor Romney would disagree with that, but the fact of the matter is you can't do these address these problems through the private sector. They're going to require government leadership, and they're going to require policies that encourage people to be smarter about the use and consumption of water. So I'm ready for questions. Yes, sir.
States to lead, look at the example that we set by our failure to sign on to the Kyoto Protocol. I don't think the lead is going to come from the United States if they haven't demonstrated that they're capable of doing it.
Well, the fact of the matter is, right now we're not leading. He said you can't count on the United States to lead because we're not doing it. The problem that you run into is that we need to start doing it. We need to become so conscious of it. We need to start electing people who begin to take a look and not worry about American exceptionalism. I think we are exceptional, and that's okay. But the fact is, what we really need to worry is about solving problems in the world that affect everybody, and the United States has to change its political climate. Unfortunately, right now, the way we do our political debate is we get involved in things that essentially don't matter. I got an email from my sister-in-law, who is a born-again, and she thinks that the President Obama ought to be impeached over the issue of Benghazi. Now, Benghazi was a real problem, okay? And people made some mistakes, I think, along the way. But on the other hand, in 1983, when we lost 241 Marines in a truck bombing in Lebanon that could easily have been avoided, when we had Marines there who were actually guarding the base but were precluded from actually having ammunition in their weapons, okay? Did anybody suggest, Republican or otherwise, that we ought to impeach Reagan about that? No, the fact is not. They said, well, we should have sent more Marines. Well, we didn't, because you don't know what the effect would have been of putting more Marines in there. You just might have had more targets. We did put 50 more Marines into Yemen recently, and it now looks like they may well become targets. So instead of talking about things that really mean something and issues that are really going to affect us down the line, our political debates are based on lies and trivia, for essentially. And I think that's horrible.
How we do the questions here is so that everybody gets a chance to do it equally. This gentleman started this side, so the next question comes from that side, and we flip back.
Oh, you've talked about the desalinization. I'm curious, how much more expensive is it to get water from desalinization than the ordinary way?
I can't give you the answer per se. It is more expensive. It requires construction. It requires attempts to get rid of the waste. We have a desalination plant up in Tampa. Screwed it up. I think some areas may find desalination smarter than others, but the fact of the matter is I don't think that's our major solution to a problem. And we don't know what the overall long-term effect would be if we started doing that in a major way. But I don't know what the additional cost is. I do know that every source you read out there will say it's more expensive, but I can't tell you per gallon what it is.
Over here, Mike.
Sure.
Yeah. Am I okay? Yeah. Space technology and water. What are they doing? What's happening up there? They have to go to the bathroom. They have to. Any ideas what's going on there?
Well, I'm not an expert on that technology, but I do know that they have had basically dry toilet technologies that takes care of the waste, and obviously they have a way of eliminating it up there. I think it's just basically put out into space eventually to come. Well, that's what they do with planes. You know, don't stand under a plane. I mean, where do you think they put that stuff? A lot of it just goes out of the plane and gone. But the fact is, I don't think that there's any major solution there. We could go into the area of chemical toilets and things like that, but that might actually go out and save water, but it might have other problems associated. The difficulty is you don't know. By the way, I will tell you flat out, I don't claim to be an international expert on water. I approach these problems like I approach the problems from my background. I'm an intelligence officer. I basically try to get the best information available. I try to put it together in a way that begins to make sense. And I try to make judgments based on that kind of thing. So don't expect that I will be able to answer every water question or every demographic question or every oil question, because I can't do that. What I can do is tell you that I approach this like I have approached most problems in my life from the perspective of an intelligence officer who looks at information and tries to go ahead and make reasoned, rational judgments.